is a show from Radio. We're a group of stations bringing new and forgotten ways of making radio to our listeners. Each week, we give artists the challenge to make radio that works across the whole of Europe and beyond.
Radiograms, nomadic cosmologies, and fugitive power. The German Pavilion at the Milan Triennale, 2022, by Red Forest. Today, by Reboot FM for Radio.
Now it seems that we are safe enough to record the conversation that we've been planning for quite some time now. A conversation with Svetlana Matveyenko. When we first met with Svetlana around 20 years ago, she was primarily a writer and editor of several groundbreaking publications about modern and postmodern Ukrainian culture, literature, film and media art. Now, Svetlana is an internationally renowned scholar and an assistant professor of critical media analysis at Simon Fraser University in Vancouver, where she is also an associate director of the Digital Democracies Institute. Her research and teaching are focused on information and cyber war, political economy of information, media and environment, infrastructure studies, and she is a co-author together with Nick Dyer Witheford of a book Cyber War and Revolution, Digital Subterfuge in Global Capitalism, which was published by Minnesota University Press in 2019. My name is Oleksiy Radinsky. I'm a filmmaker and writer based in Kyiv, Ukraine. Our conversation today also includes sound interventions created by Sasha Dolgi, a musician from Kyiv, who is using his own innovative instrument that he calls the magnetic harp. Conversation was initially meant to summarize research that we started doing last year with Svetlana and a small team of scholars who were interested in the life and work of Vladimir Vernadsky, a Soviet Ukrainian geologist and thinker who is probably best known for his formulation of the concept of the biosphere, which has become quite widespread in our everyday language. But then something happened, and our research group had to reorient ourselves towards more practical strategies of survival during wartime.
the full-scale invasion led to extreme concretization of these topics. So we will now see more because so many things became more visible, more sound, and more problematic, even if we compare to how we imagined certain relations several months ago.
Yeah, we will definitely go back to that, but can I just ask you, how do you remember the day of February 24th, 2022, when the full-scale Russian invasion of Ukraine was launched? What were you actually doing that day?
Well, that day began at midnight for me because I had a very long conversation, a phone conversation with a friend and colleague also who was a part of our research group, Ася Баздарева. And we talked about research, actually. We talked about the study of Chernobyl zone. We talked about the legacy of Vernadsky, the importance of addressing his work today, the meanings of biosphere and noosphere. And it was a long conversation. We were doing planning, some fantasies of research, expeditions to the Chernobyl zone and whatnot. I think we ended this conversation somewhere around 1 a.m. And I always get up at 5 a.m. in the morning. So at 5 a.m. when my alarm clock rang and I woke up, I also saw a telegram message from Ася, who was telling me about explosions. And because in our late night conversation, she was already telling me that she was nervous and anxious about the whole political context, I thought it was kind of related to this, and I started trying to calm her down, saying like, don't be afraid, I mean, it's probably some training. And suddenly she says, no, it's the invasion and it's all over Ukraine. I also realized that I actually didn't prepare my emergency bag, which was a thing that we were all warned to do. And I called my friends here in Kamenets-Podilsky and asked if they are ready with their emergency bags, so they were not. We went around town looking for drugs, specific drugs, for example, some medication for heart or some other simple things, and suddenly nothing was there. So people already kind of cleared the drugstores, we were told, from 6 in the morning. So this anxiety, this panic was already spreading in town. I returned home and set to write the diary, a documentation of the process of gradual militarization of everyday life that really concerned me in December and January. And I found it so disturbing. And I thought, I actually didn't think the war would happen, but I thought that this militarization would become so strong and overwhelming that it actually would change some kind of quality of our life, certain relations between us, organization of our everydayness.
But I still remember thinking on that day that we have found ourselves in a peculiar situation when On the one hand, everything in our lives is changing profoundly and irreversibly, and on the other hand, nothing in fact really changes in the sense that it's just our own reality is getting thrown into stark relief. It kind of dawned on me at some point that everything that we've been doing as artists, scholars or intellectuals simply became much more relevant and urgent since the day of the Russian invasion. And for a very long time before that, we knew that our mission was to fight fascism, extractivism and patriarchy. But on February 24th, 2022, all of these struggles had become very visceral and they ceased to be abstract at all. I even had a feeling that our research into Vladimir Vernadsky, as you've said, became more urgent since that day. Because Vernadsky's thought provides insights into modern extractivism and this extreme exploitation of natural resources that brought Putin's regime into existence in the first place. And it also helps us to comprehend the planetary implications of extractivism. Yeah, as we are now in the situation when, let's say, natural gas that's extracted in the Russian far north is burned into the atmosphere in Germany, and the money extracted from the German taxpayers in return for this gas is being used by the Russian Federation to murder Ukrainian people. On that day, the ministers of the German federal government had been meeting with Andriy Melnyk, the Ukrainian ambassador in Berlin. And they were discussing, of course, the invasion of Ukraine, which was launched by the Russian military early that day. And according to the account by Andriy Melnyk, at that meeting with the German ministers, he had to confront an opinion that only several hours have left until the crushing defeat of Ukraine by the Russian Federation, and that the delivery of weapons to Ukraine or sanctions against Russia make no sense, and instead one should look into the future and accept the reality of an occupied Ukraine with a puppet government installed by Russia. In the end, it was the German government that had agreed to construct the Nord Stream gas pipeline that is linking Russia and Germany directly via the Baltic seabed and bypassing Ukrainian gas transit routes. And by doing so, by agreeing to this deal, the German government had made it crystal clear to the Russian elites that the territory of the Ukrainian state is actually up for grabs. Yeah, we know that after the collapse of the Soviet Union, the newly independent Ukraine has been described shamefully with only one real geopolitical role on the European continent. That is the role of a transit zone enabling the deliveries of Russian fossil fuels to their European customers. And from today's perspective, the Nord Stream deal looks like a case of good old imperialism, pure and simple. It is a deal on territories and resources. But it seems that fossil fuel imperialism has a bit different stakes than the rest of us here on this planet.
Now, it probably would be more correct to speak about their complicity. So all this rivalry and competition between them, it's probably not so significant, even though somehow it pops up and draws our attention. But their complicity is what more important structural kind of foundational for how capitalist economy functions today. So we see the empires that need each other. What like this complex relation within this capitalist assemblage is what, with my co-author Nida Rutherford, we identify as cyber war, the process of rebooting and reloading of capitalism at the moment when it faces some kind of crisis. And we know from political economics theory how crisis is important for capitalism, crisis that what makes it going, right? So and through this multiple rebooting. And I'm interested in atomic infrastructures and legacies. I also see how the cyber war is shaping its very clear, very pronounced nuclear dimension.
So at the very start of the invasion of Ukraine, on that day, the Russian forces had occupied the Chernobyl nuclear power plant and used it as a shield, a nuclear shield, so to say, during their attempts to capture the nearby city of Kyiv. This takeover, of course, constitutes a new type of war crime, since never before in history had the nuclear power plant been taken over by an invading army.
Everything that concerns Chernobyl has its extreme symbolic meaning, but also extreme materiality. And that's what we see again here in how this nuclear cyber war shapes itself. I also want to remind you that cyber war, the cyber dimension, nuclear dimension has been present in cyber war for quite some time. The Stuxnet worm is known as one of the most sophisticated viruses ever discovered. A piece of software so unique, it would make history as the world's first digital weapon. And so it's interesting here because we can see a program that was installed in the computers, manually installed in the computers that were coordinating the working process of the centrifuges. So because the occupation of Chernobyl and again Zaporizhia weaponized the entire infrastructure of these plants. It actually accelerates certain threat, and that's where how this act of nuclear terrorism is being committed. So instead of slowing down, now we see a complete acceleration of the threat of potential becoming of a nuclear bomb where it was not.
During this occupation, the nature of the Chernobyl zone had actually weaponized itself in a sense that it had effectively opposed this mad and outlandish invasion of the Russian armed forces into the area of a nuclear disaster. The nature itself, yeah, the Chernobyl forest, had become a partisan army that in the end chased the invaders away. Part of the Chernobyl zone is called the Red Forest, and here I need to proudly mention that Red Forest is also the name of the collective curating this very radio program. It's called Red Forest Radiograms. Actually say that the Red Forest had become a non-human partisan forest during the Russian military occupation of Chernobyl. And in that forest, the trees, the grass, the sand, and the radiation particles buried there were actually fighting against the invaders.
These particles, parts of these objects, these pieces of graphite, which is what was in the Red Forest, buried in the Red Forest, and the encounter with those pieces were the most dangerous, not so much radioactive dust. So you could see that all these objects were, in a certain way, agents of that same empire. And here you can see how imperial objects, a kind of the slaves of that empire that were mobilized to go to this war, were consumed, killed, eaten by that empire. The empire ate their its children in a certain way, right?
It seems that our conversation is actually circling around the manifold legacies of Vladimir Vernadsky, who was actually our point of departure. So as a philosopher and geologist, which is a rare combination indeed, Vernadsky was cautiously optimistic about the technological future of humanity. Vernadsky actually believed in the virtually infinite power of human thought and science, which he also thought of as a planetary force. So in the 1920s, he developed his understanding of science as a geological force that is capable of planetary transformations. And this actually makes his ideas so relevant in the times of the so-called Anthropocene. But if we look at the ways in which Vernadsky's own scientific thought has been put into practice, we see a much less optimistic picture, yeah? Vladimir Vernadsky can easily be considered a founder or even a father figure of a Soviet extractivist industry, yeah, which became a cause of some of the worst ecological devastations in human history. So back during the World War I, Vernadsky was responsible for the exploration of natural resources of the Russian Empire, which strangely had been left largely undiscovered until the moment the empire had collapsed. And during the interwar period, Vernadsky's expertise in geological science and the exploration of natural resources became one of the cornerstones of forced modernization that was undertaken by Stalin. And this actually included the creation of the Soviet atomic industry, given Vernadsky's research into radiology. So we could say that the Chernobyl disaster is a kind of a dead end of Vernadsky's grand project of technological optimism. Because if human thought did become a geological force, then it was also necessary to account for the unconscious inherent within that thought, and what kind of geological transformations became possible.
This war doesn't look like some kind of 21st century war. Sometimes I think we are missing in all these fantasies and expectations and thinking about our futures, we are missing a very important and tragic moment when we think about regaining our borders to the borders of. So that when we think about regaining of the borders, we think about certain horizontality. We think about a horizontal territory that we can probably, hopefully, will get back. However, for me, thinking geologically, I see a very strong vertical dimension here, and it goes deep to those layers of salt and coal. And I can see how all this land, but vertically, is occupied by poison of war. Potential, its fertility. I don't know how long we actually need, right, to, even if to get our territories horizontally, I think vertically, they are lost for us for very, very, very long time. And this is one of the most horrific consequences of this war that we didn't have time even to think about much today. But that is why I think there is no victory